Ladies and gentlemen, let time stand still, let circumstance go hang, and bid expediency take a powder. Let Rome in Tiber melt, here is my space, and here yours too. This is Radio 4, this is Saturday Night Fry. Once more, holding hands around the table with me, literary love biter John Sessions with musical autolycus Richard Coles. And this week we welcome to our bosom journalist Martin Jakes. Comic producer, writer and performer Armando Iannucci. Snowy-haired falconer of the right, Sir Peregrine Wurstthorn. And rock legend Tom Robinson. And as the mighty Wurlitzer of Roy Wooten and Bob Barrett playing Valley of a Thousand Palms fades away, it is our pleasure to tear the arse out of the next 45 minutes with some heavy inference, light disputation, and medium-weight insight. You know, darlings, it occurred to me on Wednesday, as I stood at the sink rinsing, that it is quite possible that I am the most demonstrative man in Britain. By demonstrative, I mean protesting, going on the most demos and protests man in Britain. This is not because I'm a seething malcontent, but because I live in a particular part of central London. It is always on the route for any serious protest march worthy of the name. Over the last few years, whenever I've had to go out and buy a pint of milk on a Sunday morning, I would have had to join in and be borne along by the stream of humanity celebrating gay pride or countryside or demonstrating against nuclear weapons or the poll tax before ducking out and into the newsagents. Struggling back to my flat against the tide of the march is a strange experience, but oddly enough, I have been happy to be associated with all of these causes. I wonder, for the moment, whether anyone around this table, when they last went on a march, or if they can think of a cause which is worthy of a march. Tom?
I saw you on that gay pride one, actually.
I have been, indeed. I stayed longer than just route to the milkman there. And have you been on such things?
Yes, I was on the last one, which was almost cancelled and then suddenly wasn't.
Oh, that's right. The internal politics of marches is always astonishing, aren't they?
They are.
I remember the old nuclear ones. There always used to be SW people saying, "No fudge. Say no to Labour's fudge." And I went out, ducked into a Charbonnier and Walker and bought a box of fudge and said, "Have some fudge," which was considered rather frivolous. Peregrine, have you ever been on a march?
I spent 3 years of my life doing nothing else than the Oxford Light Infantry route march, right marches. But more recently, no, I have. I've been on two marches very recently. One was the countryside march and the other was the second countryside march. We walked all the way from the embankment to Hyde Park. And I also walked on the earlier ones in the country with who's that actor called?
Jeremy Irons. Jeremy, not irony, but Irons. And Richard, what about you?
I didn't go on the Gay Pride March for the first time ever this year because I've stopped believing in gay. But to my shame, I did actually go on not the countryside march, but I went to the big bonfire. Because where I live in the country, we decided to light a bonfire there, but I only went because it was free beef burgers.
Johnny?
I fear to say that the last march I went on, I was a mere slip of an elf. I was 18, and it was against Margaret Thatcher's education cuts when I was at university. Oh. Well, sort of at university.
The milk snatcher.
Yes, yeah. And I remember, to my embarrassment, and because it's a long time ago, I will say this, and it'll probably still embarrass you, I struck up a chant which was, "Thatcher, Thatcher, who was there?" Can't say the word. "Who hatched her?"
worthy of John Stuart Mill. What about Martin Jakes? You must have been on marches.
Well, I've been on lots and lots of marches, but I must confess, I cannot remember the last one I went on, because I think what happened was I went on so many when I was younger that I overdosed. Yeah. So now the idea of a march.
We went on one together.
Maybe that was my last. Yeah.
We haven't brought in Armando yet.
I think I must have been a contemporaneous marcher with John Sessions, because my last march I was on was against Thatcher's education cuts. And I remember Keith Joseph came to preach in some chapel near us at college, and we all stood outside, and this was at Oxford, and I remember there were some students from Jesus College, Oxford, with banners saying "Jesus against Joseph." And we all thought it was very, very witty to shout "Thatcher, Thatcher, Thatcher, out, out, out." "Cecil, Cecil, Cecil, in, out, in, out."
Oh, those were the days.
I
think we might return to this subject. Hold that thought, everyone. Now, last week, old hands may remember, we talked to Arnold Wesker about work in progress. This week, the fine-grained leather seat of the work in progress chair is dimpled by the charming buttocks of a man familiar to anybody who listened on this wireless station to On the Hour, quite certainly the best and funniest radio comedy in the last 10 years, or who watched its brilliant television successor, The Day Today. I'm talking about writer-producer Armando Iannucci. Scottalian Armando came blessedly out from the anonymity of the control booth to present his own Friday night armistice. He might be counted godfather, I suppose, to that extraordinary generation of talents that includes Rebecca Front, Chris Morris, Steve Coogan, Patrick Marber, Peter Bainham and David Schneider. Don Armando, work in progress. I understand you have the BBC in your sights, is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you said work in progress, and I suddenly realised I have no work in progress because I'm suddenly deciding what the relationship, my relationship is with the BBC, because I've found it... It suddenly dawned on me recently that I've lacked the will to do anything else for them.
Really?
Yes. I'm not one of these... I know the newspapers for the last 4 or 5 years have always been filled with stories of people who have left the BBC.
Yeah, John Tideman.
Usually because they've had a project turned down.
Or because they can't smoke anymore.
That's right, John Tideman. And that suddenly turns them into these sort of arch campaigners against the BBC, and I've kind of sort of resisted that. But I think something... I think a rot has been setting in very recently. There's been a very noticeable... drop in standards that's been brought about by the BBC's decision that it's got to give the public what it wants. And I think there's this plague that's starting to creep over every aspect of public life where you have to give the public what they want. And yet we're finding, I think we're going about measuring what the public wants the wrong way.
Yes.
I think William Hague's just doing his listen to the public year-long rally around the country. Forgetting that I think the campaign is called We're Listening to the People, forgetting that what the people told them was that after 18 years of incompetence, we didn't want the sound of them again. And I'm fearful of the sort of plague of focus groups that have been brought into the BBC, and this sort of tendency to think that if you ask someone who's never made a programme in their life and who doesn't really think about the ins and outs of television, radio, what they want, that they're going to feel qualified to tell you. They'll tell you what they liked, but they won't tell you what they want.
And if you ask someone, would you like to see a sitcom set in a hotel or in a nudist colony, they'd probably say nudist colony, and they would say goodbye to Fawlty Towers. It doesn't matter what things are, it matters that they're good.
Absolutely, and I think there's been a sort of paranoia creeping in the BBC, a sort of schizophrenia, because they don't quite know whether they're there to provide a public service and provide quality, or they're there to justify the licence fee by getting as many viewers and listeners as possible. I mean, I don't have a gripe, a professional gripe with the BBC, but as a viewer and listener, I've just been noticing strange things afoot. I think it reached a head the other day when I heard that Radio 3, in an effort to boost its 15 to 35-year-old age bracket, is launching a soap opera about a string quartet.
Oh, good.
As if that's what people want to listen. I don't want to hear about a...
some cellist and a
horn section losing its virginity. I can't really hear music, you know. And it's this paranoia seeping in that somehow they've got to get listeners, they've got to produce more. It's all about quantity nowadays. They've got to produce more channels, more news, 24-hour services, more digital.
Yes.
And that at the expense of quality.
Yes, it's this awful choice idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was part of Thatcherism, but it's still, you know, current now. That, you know, if you take cutlery as a metaphor, they would say, well, that too, you've got a non-silver fork and a silver knife, and get rid of those, and a huge dustbin liner full of white plastic cobblestone. You've got the choice now. The
absolutely.
But you've got choice.
I mean, there's nothing good has ever been made by a cable channel, apart from documentaries about sharks.
Are you actually going to incorporate this into work? Because Mark Taverner has written two series now, In the Red and In the Chair, which have sort of guide the BBC, but in a rather perhaps sixth-formly way, as sort of poking fun.
Well, I don't know. I sort of feel I've done my bit in terms of parodies and I feel I'm at a crossroads, and maybe you can help me, Steve.
Yes.
What should I do with this wrath and
left, eye? Right, or straight on, or backwards? It's so hard, isn't it? So I agree with you. I know what you mean. There's a strange thing as one hits middle age, one realizes that it's no longer funny. It's no longer funny to play a bishop or a general if you are at an age when you could be a bishop or a general. When you're in your 20s, it's very amusing.
Yes.
But when you're actually.
I suppose I could be controller of BBC Two now.
I think it'd be a perfect choice.
If I played my cards right.
Thank you very much, Amanda. We'll be talking to you again later, obviously. What is the point of having a radio programme with your own name stitched into its title unless you can invite heroes to come on and sing to you? Tonight we have Up Against the Wall, as one of his classics had it, the luminous Tom Robinson singing The Cold, Cold Ground with Adam Phillips on guitar.
Call me Digger, I don't have no other name, no other name. I don't want no hassle next time I'm making my claim, making my claim. Long ago, far away, my dad was an okay. A hint to the city, now I'm here to stay. Banking on the cold, cold ground. Some people cuss and kick. Spit in your face, spit in your face. Some just flip you a quid and quicken their pace, quicken their pace. If you were me, the role's reversed. Don't try to tell me you'd escape the curse. Every alternative's so much worse than begging on the cold, cold ground. I'm big, big, begging, big, big, begging. The rain keeps hammering down. I'm big, big, begging, big, big, begging. Begging on the cold, cold ground. I've got smooth white skin, so I do much better than some. Better than some. Some girls bother me, some men wanna have fun. Surfing on the world wide web, you'll forget the beggar boy you just met. Begging on the cold, cold ground. I'm big, big, begging. Big, big, begging. I'm drenched and ready to drown. I'm big, big, begging. Big, big, begging. Begging on the cold, cold ground.
Well, in keeping with our theme of protest this evening, Tom, despite the fact you're now happily, as it were, married father, you were probably associated till the day you die with glad to be gay. Does that bug you?
No, au contraire.
Yeah.
I mean, people like things to be black and white, that so-and-so is gay or so-and-so is not gay and therefore straight, but in fact, in the black, you know, it's nothing like as black and white as that, and I'd much rather say I'm glad to be grey.
Yes, yes. Well, this may be the way the world is tending, of course, and we perhaps might talk about ideology and whether it exists anymore, let alone identity. Now, that, I suppose, you could call a protest song in some ways. I mean, a lot of your songs are angry. Are you any less angry than you were in the 70s when you first came to fame with TRB?
Well, I think passionate is something I'd try to be aiming for, rather. Angry young men become angry young boars very quickly. So, and in a, particularly in a case of having written a song like Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay, you know, what do you write next? Glad to Be Gay Strikes Back, or Part 2 or 3, or, you know, Son of Glad to Be Gay. Well, we may yet get to that, of course.
But, that's the ambivalence. It doesn't quite have the same ring, does it?
So I think you have to move on and just write about things that move you to write, as and when they do move you. I mean, you know, we're talking about pop music here, which is not hardly the sort of the most passionate and intense art form of the world has ever seen. But within your own small field, that's what you try and do. You write about things that move you.
Glad to be great. It would be all right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the best story I ever heard was I got a letter from an American teenager in the late 70s who told me that he'd told his mother that he was gay, and she had completely freaked out and disowned him, saying, you know, I wish you'd never been born, you're the spawn of the devil, I never want you to darken my doors again. Absolutely the most murderous, fundamental Christian sort of nonsense against this child. And he'd gone upstairs, taken a huge overdose of aspirin, and put on the radio as he lay on his bed to die. And Glad to Be Gay came on the radio, and he went to the sink and stuck his finger down his throat, left home, and lived happily ever after. And I thought, that's the most marvellous story, which made it worth having written the song.
Yes, not many songwriters can say that, can they? I mean, songwriters like Morrissey might have actually driven people the other direction.
Not many songwriters can say that they're glad that their song made someone sick.
I threw up when I heard it. I still shudder with some embarrassment, Tom, at my attempts to imitate your accent when I was a teenager, you know, especially from motorway, you know, to go, little white line, things like that. And nowadays, of course, public school boys go around in untied trainers, imitating the urban ghetto talk of South Central Los Angeles. Upper classes seem to be obsessed with boring the cool of the poor. John Sessions, I believe, has found this to be true north of the border.
He paced his room in the west end of Glasgow in a state of the most feverish apprehension. Would it work, he asked himself. This was not the moment to be circumspect, however, and he downed the measure in one draft and another, even as he thumbed through the pages in his trembling hand, pages which constituted an altogether different kind of draft. One for the silver screen, through which, so covetously did he pray, he would one day walk with the elect and hold aloft the golden statuette. He cursed the half-bottle of McAllister for its ineffectual tardiness. So far, only a certain sluggish warmth distilled itself within his innards. The man from the Glasgow Herald would be there in the room in less than 20 minutes, and the whiskey had still a mighty business to attend to. It had to wash away all traces of the sauncy-faced lad who'd done embarrassingly well at Kiel Academy and was rather fond of moderately priced Italian shoes and lay before the world an altogether more intransigent figure. One whose grandfather had been laid off by Fairfield Yard, had been a gang member of the Monks, had known Jimmy Boyle, had stood shoulder to shoulder with Jimmy Reed during the UCS dispute. As he surveyed the room for final checks, his face blanched with horror. True, he had cleared out the rugs, the pale and tasteful prints, the wrought-iron chair made by a vivacious friend who now lived in Montepulciano. But the vermilion scatter cushion still lay on the pile of daily records and syringes. And a Paul Smith waistcoat was hanging on the back of the door. Cursing himself, he threw them into one of the many bin liners he'd asked his Auntie Jean to bring when she dropped off his weekly supply of rhubarb and ginger jam. He stopped, catching himself in the mirror. Yes, the effect was good. Wearing the donkey jacket indoors, though, no, was that an excessive detail? No, he thought not. The central heating had been turned off all day. The room would be as he wanted it, chilly and as precisely uninviting as was required. The T-shirt, yes, perfect, junky yellow. The jeans, painful. Oh, the whiskey would help that, and the pain in turn would help the look. There only remained the voice. He watched his dry lips part and utter the wonderful sounds.
How you doing, man? You say the Herald, right? Bit nonsense for me. No tears here, but there's nothing wrong with the flare, so give me your daughter, and I'll tell you the story of my life.
Not bad, he thought. There was a ring at the bell. He looked once again in the mirror, and now another voice within him rose as from a long-forgotten nightmare. Fraser, if he says he's heard your sister's called Lindsay, and that she owns a patisserie in Bath Street, you just say, Mister, why don't you get to fuck... The doorbell rang again. He clumped down the stairs in his army surplus boots as loudly as he felt his neighbour, Miss McNiven, who taught the bassoon, would allow. He tore open the door.
Ewan McGuck, Tommy Findlayson, Glasgow Herald. It's not a bad part of town you can hold up in. Is that a bassoon I hear?
Right, man, jazz band for next door. You know, guy playing can hardly hold the thing, you know, what with all the needles in his arm.
Acupuncture, right.
Oh, Herald sent a comedian.
Oh, it's just a wee joke.
Aye, wheeze the word. Get your feet in the air up the stairs.
The journalist was about his own age, and his shoes and complexion confirmed a background no less comfortable. Would he recognise him, Fraser suddenly wondered. From Scottish country dancing classes, perhaps, when Fraser was 10 and won a prize at the Cowell Highland Games? No, he would take no chances. He threw himself in the corner, letting as little light as possible fall on him from the bare bulb. The journalist produced a tiny tape recorder.
Well, Ewan, you've really gone for the five-star squalor here, right?
Fraser felt his other self howl with outrage within him. He'd wanted to haul Tommy into the back room and display the expansive sofa which 3 years as a software salesman had enabled him so effortlessly to acquire. But no, the whiskey held his other fearsome self in check.
That's the way I like it, Tommy, you know, just me and my writing. No bourgeois bullshit to clog up the thrapple of my muse.
Yeah, well, with the Scottish Film Board green-lighting your script, your muse must be singing like Pavarotti.
There's that.
Where's Pavarotti? Is that what you said, Ewan? Come on, you're living in Mary Hill, no outer space.
Tommy was right. Definitely a bridge too far. An extra coating of syrup on the rhubarb that could endanger the entire cake shop. Why was he thinking of cakes? He must not on any account mention cakes. That would lead on to Lindsay and the patisserie and...
So, Ewan, a bit of background. It was a hard one, I understand, from the guy on the record.
Ah, hard enough, man. Drum chapel, mother and father on the brew.
I thought your father was dead before he came along.
What?
Oh, yeah, man, you know, came with a programme. A real Vader, you know. He died. You know, he was stabbed at the top of a crane in Scott Lithgow's by six guys for the tongs. Oh, that'd be the rock climbing chapter of the tongs. Could they not just wait for your father to come down off the crane and then life him? Tommy, nice middle class boy like you obviously doesn't tune into the ways of the street. If they stabbed him down below, we'd have seen that. People had to see his perforated body plummeting through the sky as a warning. All right, so where'd you learn to write? Approved school. See, there was this old guy, say, Berlini, a lifer, and they brought him along to put us all back on the rails. You know, fat chance of me, huh? Anyway, so he puts me on to Brecht and Gramsci and Andre Malraux, and he really got me to see the light, you know, the intellectual light. An actual point of fact. That's an interesting turn of phrase for you, Ewan.
Oh, dear. The doorbell rang again. In his panic at the possibility of detection, Fraser pulled the tea cloth off the intercom and pressed it. Just in time, he remembered the right voice.
Oh, why is one?
The voice, amplified by the intercom, flowed unstoppably into the room.
Who's that? Is that Fraser there?
It was his Auntie Jean. Auntie Jean, who still bought him boxer shorts and carried pictures of him everywhere in his kilt with his smarmy wee hair and smarmy wee smile and...
You don't sound like one of Fraser's friends. Now look, I've got my own key and I'll be coming on up just to see what in the name of goodness is going on up there.
Fraser's eyes spun back to Tommy, trying to stop the terror from showing in his face. Tommy looked puzzled. He would not, however, be puzzled for long. There was a key in the door. It was closely followed by a rosy-faced woman with rinsed hair, a CNA scarf, and a look of no-nonsense in her cornflower eyes.
Fraser McFarkerson, in the name of heaven, would you look at yourself? You're like one of those junkies you see down at the Brimley Law. The sooner someone fire hoses them into the Clyde and runs them down with nuclear submarines, the better. I don't know what's worse, darkies or junkies. Who's this, may I ask? I'm from the Herald, Mrs.
Tommy had dispensed with his tape recorder and was now writing furiously.
Don't you miss me, you lout. I'm saying lout, but at least you've got a passable pair of brogues on, which is more than you can say about my nephew here. You'd never have believed this dapper wee feet doing the reels over in Cowell. 10 years of age, the first year his mother and father took him to Italy to see Siena and Florence, and a fat lot of good it did him, clearly. Now, where's that lovely sofa I helped choose for him? Fraser? Fraser!
She bustled off into the adjoining room, letting out little exclamations of horror.
Goodness gracious!
As she went, Tommy Findlayson was out the door and away, descending the stairs so loudly that the bassoon teacher from below came out to berate him in ringing Kelvinside tones. Fraser turned to the mirror. No amount of the potion could bring back the oh-so-desired other self now. There was only one terrible self he could now live with, and he was looking at it. The white lips parted and issued forth a terrible sound.
Auntie Jean, if you just sit down and have a coffee, I'll explain.
Oh, Johnny, thank you. That was absolutely splendid. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you, Johnny. We are a Protestant culture. From Luther's 95 nailed proclamations in Wittenberg by way of Peterloo and Aldermaston, Jarrow and Swampy, our history has always been one of being Protestant. Is or was Martin Jakes, once edited Marxism Today, went on to found the government's favourite private sector think tank. Martin, your path, if you'll forgive the obvious, is one from demos to demos. I'm sorry, it looks better in print. Is the age of protest really over, do you think?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence for that. The nature of protest, the subject of protest, has changed. But then, it's always been changing. But the way in which people protest, and not just the kind of subjects, but the way in which people protest, the forms they use, the way it resonates with the country, the political system, that is changing.
Yes. And is that a result of a change in ideology? Are people no longer ideologically bound, but bound by single issues, do you think?
Yeah, I think that what's happened is that protest has become unstitched from politics, if you like. That once, you know, as you go back progressively, you see that protest tended to be the adjunct of a party, in particular the left, you know, the Labour movement, as it used to be called. And in some way, even in the 60s, when already it was breaking clear, CND didn't really have much to do with party politics, but it did in some ways mimic it and thought of itself as kind of an adjunct of the left. Whereas today, I don't think that's true at all. I think, you know, if you're talking about the road protest or, you know, you mentioned Swampy, movements around sexuality, race and so on, people don't think Steve Bryant's campaign, they don't think, you know, somehow or other the Labour Party is, you know, is our party.
Right, now, Sir Peregrine Westall, you tend to be thought of residing the other side of the picket fence, as it were. In the past, while others were holding torchlight vigils outside South Africa House in Trafalgar Square, You were less critical of apartheid, and I think you said recently that this feeling was what you called a kind of pleasure in perversity, which motivated you almost to protest at protesters. Do you think we're better off without protest? I know you've described yourself as a nicer man now than you were.
We'll always get protest, because there are always things that people love and even more true things that people hate. So you will always find that there are plenty of causes cropping up, new ones we probably can't imagine. And I think perhaps what you were saying in your introduction really should be rephrased to say that the class protest is probably a thing of the past. You're not going to get the working class protest about poverty, or you won't get the, if you like, people marching in an organized mass class sense. And so it'll be much more local, much more, as I think Martin was really saying, not exactly individual protests, but groups protesting about things which you can't organize because they're only felt by particular groups. So I don't think you're going to get the sort of mass revolutionary marches of the past, but you're going to get marches. Of course, they're going to be, I think, probably now, in a way, conservative marches. I mean, I think what arouses people's passions at the moment are that change is too fast, that they want to hang on to things that they're familiar with, have grown to love, and they don't wish to see villages destroyed, they don't wish to see all the modern developments which frighten them and alarm them, and they will join together as Swampy did against Rhodes, say. So I think you'll get it more conservative-minded protesting, which I suppose could be symbolised by the anti-hunt, the defence of hunting.
Defence of hunting march. And I suppose, I mean, it's not too much to imagine Norman Tebbit in perhaps 10 years' time marching against Europe, against a single currency, for example. I mean, the kind of man you would never imagine marching.
I think anger is more likely to come in the immediate future from the right than from the left, because although, if you like, capitalism has won the battle, the right-wing instincts were never particularly keen on capitalism. There are many causes dear to the right, privilege being one of them. and nothing makes people protest more strongly than you take away their privileges.
I remember Cambridge, we used to hold, which I hasten to say, but ironic, grass shoots against racism. And things.
It worked.
Sort of, you know.
Interesting idea demanding privilege for all.
Yes, that's somewhat self-contradictory. Yes.
There was a graffiti that I saw recently, and it said, "Don't vote, make trouble." And I think that's as good an attitude. But that's political. I mean, it isn't political in the party sense.
Exactly. And it's a very British one. I think, Martin, you've written before about the instincts of the British are both those of conservative sense of kind of status quo as well as creative radicalism. And they're both as instinctively British, and they can be mixed in different... I can feel radical and angry about things and very, very conservative about others. And I think that's a good thing.
Because you say radical... Technology is so profoundly radical now. Why do you want to add political radicalism? I mean, the world is going to change. Nothing to do with politics. It's changing almost every day before one's eyes, so to speak. The whole idea of stagnation is now something which technology takes care of. You don't need a lot of political protest because the world is being changed. Good or ill. And the whole aim now of individuals is to slow the process down.
But
conservatism is the wave of the future.
You could only do that by politicising it, wouldn't you, Martin?
Well, it's not just by sort of resisting change. It's by wanting to exercise some control over the nature of change. I mean, if you're talking about sort of Brent Spar, then people wanted a say in how that rig was going to be disposed of. I think the Rhodes thing is fascinating because, actually, one of the fascinating things about protest is how many times it actually prefigures what's going to happen. I mean, you know, you might say, well, Swampy's failed and all that kind of thing. Actually, I don't think that's true.
The government
I think that what happens with Swampy and these kind of characters is that they are,
But he's not a radical.
Change always comes from the young.
Well, Swampy is exactly not. He's the very opposite. Come on, Martin, you're not going to... pretend that there's any sort of radical political aim about it. Swampy simply wants, he doesn't like The idea of tearing up the countryside or tearing down the trees. Well, nor does any Conservative.
Like Stephen.
Well, Lord Blake. I'm not going to say Blake would have joined the Labour Party.
But Perry, like Stephen was saying, actually, in Swampy is both a conservatism and a radicalism. I think the two things are strung together.
I can't argue with that.
He doesn't want to have change, but in some ways, he doesn't want to, you know, the countryside to change and so on. But actually, if we could roll back the car, this would be an extremely radical change in the way in which we all live, the cities which we occupy, the way we travel to work, the way we use our bodies.
No one said it wasn't. I mean, William Morris was radical but retrograde. But, I mean, there's nothing.
I'm perfectly prepared to agree that there could be an undemocratic. I mean, let's not introduce the word fascism. I can see that there could be a lot of radicalism, I think I said, from the right. But I was asking you, where is the great Marxist impulse coming from? It isn't, that's the point.
No, Amanda, now, thank you for that. New Labour is often criticised for being bland, non-ideological, without politics, without identity. But surely, isn't that what we always wanted? Wasn't Barham sort of
what
cliche?
The people want.
Wasn't that the cliche? Why do they always have to slag each other off? Shouldn't we actually be celebrating that? Or do you think it is something that's gone out of life? You know?
Well, yes, and then people have discovered that they've voted in something rather bland. I think there is also, I mean, protest seems to go in trends. You know, in the 70s and 80s, it was trendy to personalise protest and have a go at Tebbit or whatever, and nowadays that just seems so as out of fashion as clothes from the 80s, or, you know, it seems laughable to do that.
You can't imagine the Gordon Brown riots.
Yes, absolutely. Well, not yet. And yeah. Wait till it all unravels. But I sort of imagine that there are also people have become more aware that in more ways in the 90s, politicians are becoming more and more powerless. You know, the campaigns that seem to ignite people are rather general things against issues like the country or beef or roads. Something like that. It's not against Brown or Blair or Hague.
But Europe will change all that, won't it? If we go into Europe, there will be a new possibility, a new whole area for rioting, for protesting. I mean, we don't get a federation coming together without tremendous threats, even in America.
People think it's all that bad an idea.
I don't mean that, but there will be economic tensions, there will be angry groups who feel that they are being discriminated against. There will be the whole area of economics will be very painful for certain groups of people, and they won't be able to make their protests through democratic means. Goodbye.
Yes.
And that's fair. That is the bottom line, to use that awful phrase, of the whole business. If we suddenly found our localised and ran out of leverage paper one week and then bread the next and then sugar the next, within a very, very short space of time, we'd be behaving like Serbians, wouldn't we? I mean, we have to confess that it's our very prosperity and our very quantity of leverage paper that keeps us pliant, our bread and surface.
The interesting thing, our notion of power has changed so much. I mean, in the old days, we thought of power, following exactly your point, that politicians had power. Mm. We thought of it in a very, very narrow and subscribed way. Whereas, you know, with the 60s, with feminism, with the gay movement and so on, we now understand power in a much more diversified way. We know that power resides in, there are many different kinds of power. And actually, the way protest movements have developed mirrors that. You know, so they might be campaigning vis-a-vis, you know, multinationals or whatever it is. There's all sorts of targets now of protest.
It's the McDonald's trial.
The G.K. Chesterton in me always celebrates when people stop blaming other people and start looking inwards to themselves at almost any issue. I mean, of course, there are occasions where there is brute tyranny that is absolutely recognisable, and it is someone else's fault, but it's nearly always worth while not falling into the sort of cheap slanging of God, aren't our politicians awful? Well, you know, really, they're not any more awful than anyone else's politicians or ever have been, or the neighbours, or yourself, frankly. Yeah. I suppose the old thing that perhaps will never come back, perhaps it will, is the great 60s tradition of protest music. Do you think, Richard, yourself, that there is a connection between protest music and protest, and have we seen the last of it? And was it a recent thing only in the 1960s?
Well, I've been asking myself if the culture of protest is really a peculiarly modern phenomenon, and I'd argue no, and you would too, Stephen, if you'd looked, as I have, at the music of the European courts of the 17th and 18th centuries. Now, Versailles, Brandenburg, and the Chapel Royal could hardly be described as hotbeds of dissent, but even in the authoritarian and absolutist court circles of Louis XIV, Margrave Christian Ludwig, and Elizabeth Tudor, disturbing evidence can be found of the subversive impulse. Now, we begin at the Palace of Versailles at the end of the 17th century, where François Couperin provided music for what was probably the most formal court that ever danced a saraband. Suites, occasional pieces, dances, and sacred works flowed from his pen. This little-known harpsichord piece was composed for a ball in honour of the Duc de Vichy, the scourge of Africa, on his return from the Dark Continent with the first cargo of slaves. Cardinal Richelieu used to say, a mandler. Extraordinary evidence there of music's power to insinuate subversive messages. But it wasn't only the French court that nurtured dissent at its bosom. 30-odd years later, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote a set of concerti for the Margrave of Brandenburg, the ruler of what was soon to become the Kingdom of Prussia. But to my great surprise, in the slow movement of the little-known C major concerto, if we listen carefully, we can hear again the voice of protest. It has something to do with all those domineering aristocrats in wigs. But even closer to home, Stephen, I found an example of courtly music expressing not so much protest, more a unified, coherent worldview, one radically opposed to the status quo. William Byrd was organist at the Chapel Royal of Elizabeth I, that unsparing monarch and unstinting advocate of the notion of royal supremacy. But even as the Catholics crackled at stakes across the Protestant realm of England, Byrd was giving voice to a finer sensibility, concealed though it was, in this little-known pavane. That's such a lovely sentiment, I'll leave it there.
Oh, fantastic. Indeed. Thank you, as well, Richard Cole. You know, I swear I was listening to Radio 3 once in its good old days when the announcer said, and now for some plain bird song. Which was very sweet. Yes. Have you actually ever written any protest songs yourself?
Well, countless ones. I mean, my embarrassment, when Martin was talking about embarrassment earlier, mine's of a more recent vintage, because in the 1980s I was in a pop band called the Communards.
Indeed.
Our ambition then was to bring down Margaret Thatcher with pop at precisely the time when the rest of the world acknowledged that Margaret Thatcher was, in fact, representing a sort of global change that was coming along to change everything. So Well, I mean, it worked in the end. She went in when 1991, I suppose.
Largely thanks to the communists.
Cool, but the embarrassment about that, I mean, the irony of it was that it's not an embarrassment, really. It's kind of a cosy thought, really, was that at precisely the time that we were trying to bring down Thatcher with pop, we were becoming Thatcherite phenomenon ourselves. You know, we became entrepreneurial, small businessmen, small employers. It was an irony which was not, well, it wasn't lost to me at the time.
And she wouldn't conform absolutely to the polarisation either. There are many stories which are well ratified. There is a story, of course, when Trevor Nile and Peter Hall turned up and said, we're here to talk about arts funding, and she looked at them like they were children, saying, we want you to come to the burial of our dormice. and then there is a story, of which is also well attested, that she was talking to someone who said, oh, Philip Larkin, wonderful poet. She quoted the whole of the Arundel tomb perfectly.
Mm.
So she would not absolutely... I mean, she was a human being.
She was never what her enemies wanted her to be.
But she was, more complicated.
Exactly. You adored her, Perry, didn't you?
I admired her very much. I think, I think she did a great... She was a real revolutionary.
Are we recording her obituary?
And didn't spill much blood in the process.
It sounds as if we're recording her obituary now.
her life as a politician is over, presumably, so we can talk about her in the past. But I think she was a magnificent political influence in this country.
Garden, and, of course, and she could be pleasant, and she could be interesting, and she'd be the effect of her politics, of course, were massively...
Again, quite extraordinarily difficult. I think it was you were talking about... You at one time hated Mrs. Thatcher and felt that she was really a monster. To somebody who's lived like you have in the same period, perhaps not of Hitler, but certainly of Stalin, and of many other monsters, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, and so on, how you can... I don't know what you then call these monsters. I mean,
well, Perry, I think you hate your own monsters, because it's more shame. You're rather ashamed to live in a country that can erect as a leader and admire someone.
No, I never...
It comes from yours.
Obviously, I don't agree.
I think most people would confess that Pol Pot and Stalin were greater monsters.
Come on, Mrs. Thatcher wasn't a monster, period.
No, but you
I didn't hate... I can't think of any Labour politician... British Labour politician that I've ever hated. It seems to be a wholly inappropriate reaction, really, to anybody who's conducted their lives in British politics. I don't feel they're hateful objects.
No.
Ludicrous, harmful... Yes. Undesirable.
We were immature, and we used words like hate, but I think it expressed a sense of shame of being in a country led by her, which we didn't like. We felt it embarrassing that she should represent.
I'm going to rush to Perry's defences. I mean, I think that you can't just say she was all bad and evil and so on. I mean, because what she succeeded in doing was understanding a lot of what was happening in the world, in British society. And leaving her own mark on it. Now, maybe we didn't like the mark. The problem was that she understood which way things were moving much better than, the political political side that a lot of us are.
You see, I was in
Tom. The brutality with which the miners and their families were treated in the mid-80s, there were people who were absolutely not political in the traditional sense, who were completely politicised by what went on there. The brutality of the way that they were handled by the police. People completely law-abiding suddenly found themselves on the wrong side of police baton charges. Yeah. And it's hard to remember that post-war happening in any other time in our society to ordinary citizens who hadn't asked for any trouble being treated in that way. And I think you can't blame people for being absolutely furious with a woman.
Well, when the police, mounted police charge a fascist demonstration, you say they asked for it.
But these were not fascists.
Well, nor were many.
Nor indeed communists.
I'm saying that if you do, and there's no question this was a kind of civil war, this was a definite attempt to bring down the system by Arthur Scargill, and I don't think that the methods that were used, given the challenge, were all that brutal, and I think, anybody listening to this thing outside this country would say, even any Parisian students who faced the CRS in Paris during the revolution, the troubles in 68, they would begin to say that they think our police are gentle as lambs by comparison.
This is not
our remit to talk about this. It's been fascinating doing it, and I suppose on the Thatcher thing I would end with a thought from the great poetess Eleanor Fargin, who wrote the book The Kings and Queens of England, and she was describing Queen Elizabeth: nasty, jealous, suspicious and mean, but England was England when Bess was the Queen. Well, now the big hand is pointing at good, the little hand is pointing at bye, the second hand sweeps urgently towards darlings, but before it gets there I have time to thank the litter of frisky love puppies that have pranced and nibbled and licked and wriggled in my guest basket this evening. They are Sir Peregrine Worsthorn, Amanda Iannucci, Martin Jakes, Tom Robinson, Richard Coles, and of course John Sessions, who will be back with me this time next week. Make sure you are too. The second hand has made it. It's exactly goodbye, darlings.